Here we go.
Okay.
Hello, and welcome to the third of three exciting NABBW teleseminars we are hosting this month. In a moment, I will introduce tonight's guest, Susan Santangelo, but first let me introduce myself and tell you a bit about NABBW and how the call will go tonight. For those of you who do not know me, I am Ann Holmes, the Boomer-in-Chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, which is found online at www.nabbw.com. And we have a forum site at www.boomerwomenspeak.com. Our websites are the number one sites found via the major search engines when you search on the keywords Baby Boomer Women. If you're not a member of the NABBW, and I know that a number of you on the call are not, we welcome you to join us. You'll find a handy link on the front page of the NABBW website, which you can use to join. This teleseminar tonight is an example of one of the many benefits we provide our members. We have almost 70 teleseminars, which we've done in the past, which are available via written transcript and audio recording. These are yours with membership in NABBW. You won't see them on the site if you're not a member, because they're not a part of the public site, but they are archived in the members-only area. I mentioned that we are doing three teleseminars this month, which is very exciting for me. Even better, I'm proud to announce that we'll be doing three teleseminars again in July and August, so we feel that this is an example of the kind of solid content that we offer to our members. Last week, we hosted Erica Miner for the first of the three this month, talking about the power of journaling and how it saved her life. And yesterday, we talked with Vicki Stark about her book, Runaway Husbands, and the phenomenon she has labeled Wife Abandonment Syndrome. So I'm proud to tell you that we'll be lightening things up today as we talk to author Susan Santangelo about her series of mystery novels for baby boomer audiences, which she calls the Carol and Jim Andrews Baby Boomer Mystery Series. They feature a boomer couple who solve mysteries. The first book was Retirement Can Be Murder, and Susan tells me she's hard at work on her second book, so I'm hoping that we'll be able to read it soon. And the title for that book is Moving Can Be Murder. I notice the murder theme is included in each book, and I think that I like that. We're talking about the books as well as how to write fiction for baby boomer audiences as we do the call tonight. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the format for our call. I'll be introducing Susan in a moment, and then she and I will spend about 30 minutes discussing her book, which has received great reviews. In fact, let me tell you a little bit about the reviews before I go on with the format of the call. I'm proud to tell you that Midwest Book Review calls it an entertaining and lighthearted read from a real pro. The Baby Boomer Mystery Series is as germane as Murder, She Wrote. It would make a great television series, and having read the book, I agree with that. And Booklist says, we'll be looking forward to more boomer mysteries in the years to come. Pure fun. All right. Now, during the first 30 minutes, I'll be moving pretty fast here with the questions because I have a lot of questions to ask Susan, and I want to make sure we get them all in. And so I won't be taking questions from the audience. But after that, we'll open the call up to questions from you. And we hope that you will, our listeners, bombard us with your questions. So without further delay, please let me introduce today's guest, and we'll launch right into our discussion. Susan Santangelo has been a freelance writer and editor for over 20 years. She's worked as a feature writer, drama critic, and editor for daily and weekly newspapers and magazines in the New York metropolitan area, including a stint at Cosmopolitan magazine. A public relations and marketing professional, which is my background as well, Susan, so sometime we should talk about how I might be able to believe that I could actually become an author. Susan was president of her own special events agency, Events Unlimited, in Princeton, New Jersey. One of her proudest professional accomplishments is managing special events for Carnegie Hall's centennial season, including the opening of the Carnegie Hall Museum. In 1999, after successful treatment for breast cancer, she began the Breast Cancer Survival Center, BCSC, an all-volunteer, not-for-profit, which provides free post-treatment education and support services to to breast cancer survivors and their families. Thousands of breast cancer survivors and family members have benefited from BCSC services since its inception. Susan has received many professional honors, including the Local Hero Award by the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation. She also was honored by the American Cancer Society with its first Angel Award for showing exemplary contributions to cancer patients and their families and demonstrating undying compassion in the fight against cancer. Susan is a member of the Sisters in Crime and the Cape Cod Writers Center and divides her time between the Connecticut shoreline and Cape Cod, Massachusetts. When she's not writing, Susan shares her life with her personal beloved husband, Joe, her two adult sons, Mark and Dave, and three English Cocker Spaniels, Tilly, Tucker, and Lucy. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne, very much. Good to be here.
We're glad to have you. Now, Susan, I've read your book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
For those people who haven't read it, its title is Retirement Can Be Murder. And then also on the front cover it says, Every Wife Has a Story, first in the new series. And then it says, A Carol and Jim Andrews Baby Boomer Mystery. So this information brings to my mind that it's a serial sort of novel that we're going to have lots of Carol and Jim Andrews stories, which I think is a great concept because there's I'm a big reader, and a lot of my favorite detective novels seem to be in series. For example, I like Patricia Cornwell, who has her Case Scarpetta novel series, and Sue Grafton, you know, has Kinsey Millhone with her Alphabet series. And then, of course, Donald Bain has his Jessica Fletcher series, Murder, She Wrote, which your books have actually been compared to in some of the reviews, which I think means that we should be looking for a television series for
you. Wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, it would. And then another series that I like that I don't think is quite as popular is Diane Mott Davidson, who has a culinary mystery series featuring a Colorado caterist named Goldie Schultz, and it has interesting titles for the books like Fatally Flaky or Dark Torch. She seems to have a use of the double entendre. And, of course, we can't forget James Patterson, who has Alex Cross and the Women's Murder Club. So with that background, I'm going to be asking you a little bit about how you came up with the concept and how you envision the story arc. I think that there probably is going to be a long-term plan that you have for Carol and Jim. Is that correct?
It is correct, yep. I think that when you reach a certain age in life, you begin to take a look at what's going on. And I think when you reach a certain age, maybe women are sort of not looked upon favorably in some ways. I mean, we're not young anymore, but we're not old either. There's a lot of wonderful things that are going on in life, and I didn't really feel that the fiction community was taking a look at that. Since boomers are hitting 60, there's been so many stories in the newspaper about financial planning and, you know, long-term care insurance and all that kind of thing, but nobody seemed to be really taking a look at issues that affect couples, the emotional issues that face a couple once the husband may be retiring. And there are so many things that we have to deal with now, and we're not dealing with them the way our parents did, that's for sure. And so I thought it would be fun to write a series of mysteries dealing with those kinds of topics, and the first one I chose was retirement.
Okay, well, that seems like the place to start, since the beginning there, of course, is that Carol has been staying at home, running the house, and Jim has been working, but he starts out by telling her that he's thinking of retiring, and she suddenly sees that life is going to change. So for those people who, I won't give away much of the book, but I'll just say that the story starts when Carol, dreading Jim's retirement, tries to suggest that he consult with a retirement coach, which he does, and then the next thing we know, Jim is suspected of murdering the coach. So that really gets us off to an interesting start there with a lot of the potential emotional impact of retirement, and yet you've given us some fun and intrigue to move us along with the story. So I guess I'd have to ask what might be an obvious question, but maybe not. What inspired you to write this story?
Well, my husband was facing retirement, And my husband is also a writer. He writes a lot of nonfiction. He writes press releases. He writes for magazines and newspapers. And we were looking for a project originally that we could work on together. So the original idea was that we were going to write a mystery together. And I had already thought of the title Retirement Can Be Murder because I thought that was just kind of a funny title. Mm-hmm. And I sort of sprung this on him one morning in our kitchen here on Cape Cod. And he kind of looked at me and said, oh, we're going to write a mystery. I said, well, yeah, let's try this. You're a good writer. I'm a good writer. Let's do something together. And so he said, well, I'm not really sure where you're going with this, but why don't you write the first chapter? So I said, okay. So I already had an idea in my mind about how the story was going to start. So I sat down and I wrote the first chapter, and I showed it to him. And the original concept was it was going to be a husband and wife conversation, by which I mean the first chapter was going to be from the wife's point of view, and the second chapter was going to be from the husband's point of view, and it's going to be sort of like going back and forth.
He's
so
kind of thing.
Exactly. So I showed it to him, and he said, well, this is really kind of cute. Write the second chapter. And by the time I got to chapter 5, and there was nothing else going on, I thought, you know, I don't think he's really going to do this. And he said, you know, this is not my thing, but why don't you write it and I'll critique it? And I thought, you know, I really don't want that to be a critique kind of a situation with me, but I'm going to plug ahead. So I completely went back to the beginning, and I started rewriting it again from just the wife's point of view. It's told in the first person. And so I had a lot of fun with it. I got to have fun with playing with some of the foibles of husbands and wives and some of the conversations, some of the situations, some of the things that when you've lived with someone for a long time kind of get on your nerves. And it really turned out actually a lot more fun than I expected it to be. He was very supportive through the whole process. So, and somebody once asked me, I was doing a book signing here on Cape Cod, and somebody said to me, is this a how-to book where, you know, the husband kills the wife or the wife kills the husband? And let's just go right on the record here and say, that's not what the story's about. The husband mm-hmm. doesn't kill the wife doesn't kill the husband, but they really learn how to work together to kind of get the husband out of hot water, which he's inadvertently mm-hmm. found himself in.
Right. Okay. And would you say that the reason that you decided to write a mystery targeted at baby boomers or about baby boomers was simply because being a baby boomer, it's the concept of writing about what you know?
I think.
Or was there more to it?
Well, I think we're always told in writing, and I've been writing for years, but not fiction, to write what you know. And I think that when you're surrounded by this, when you're living this every day, people say, where do you get your inspiration from? And truly, it's all around us, I think. You can go to the supermarket and overhear conversations. Our friends are talking about this. It's such an important part of what's going on in the world today. There are so many of us, Anne, you know, around. And I think a lot of people may not be married anymore, maybe divorced, maybe widowed, whatever, but there are so many of us who are still married. Maybe we're married to the first person we were married to. Maybe people are remarried. But there's a lot of relationship issues that happen as we age. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that I wanted to talk about. And I wanted to talk about communication between a husband and a wife. And actually it could be transferred into any partnership or any relationship between like an adult child and a parent. The communication issue, I think, is really key, and that's part of the book, I think.
Okay. Well, certainly, seeing as my husband and I live and work together 24/7, I would definitely have to agree that communication is a huge key. We didn't start out that way when we got married, but along the way, I started a PR and marketing company with an area of expertise in interactive technology, which was actually what he was more knowledgeable about. But eventually he quit his job and joined me. So now
wow.
we have a situation where we work out of our home and we have a business together. So and we're not retired. You know, we're definitely working. But I certainly know that people are asking me all the time, how do you manage to be this 24/7 togetherness thing? So I know it's, and my sister tells me, her husband is a little bit older than she is, and she tells me that she's very afraid of the concept of when her husband Jim will retire.
He's a Jim also.
yes, he is. So in that case, you know, I from talking to my sister, I know that, well, my husband Steve and I have managed to do this, and I think do it very well. I think you've hit on a topic that, that people are hugely concerned about, and that is that we're living longer as baby boomers, and so as we reach retirement age, we have a lot of time ahead of us, and spouses have to remember what did we like about each other.
That's right. And there are so many issues that, that face us. The first book is about retirement because I sort of felt that that needed to be the beginning. And the subhead for that, by the way, is every wife has a story because I'm a wife, and so it's told in the first person. But the second book that you alluded to when you gave me that really nice introduction is about moving, and it's about downsizing and selling the family home. You reach an age where maybe the house may become too big for you. You want a first floor bedroom. You don't want to climb those stairs anymore. And so you decide you're going to put the house on the market, and you're going to, and then where are you going to go? Are you going to go into an active adult community? Are you going to go into a condo situation? You're going to go to Florida? Where are you going to go? And so that's the second piece of this series. And I have at least five titles in mind for the series. I don't think I'm going to get as far as Sue Grafton did with all of her alphabet people, but but that's not my long-term goal. But, you know, there's so many different topics to write about. And, of course, you know, a dead body always makes things a little bit more interesting, don't you think? Just one, though. Just one. And it's not I'm the kind of person who loves to read mysteries. I was raised on Nancy Drew. I loved Nancy Drew when I was a kid. And I don't think I ever really got over it, the mystery genre. I really love the funny, light, entertaining kinds of mysteries. I love Janet Ivanovich, for instance. I think she's a wonderful writer. I love Joan Hess, who's very funny. And I like to be entertained. And I think that in the world today, there's so many serious things that are going on. You don't even have to, you just have to go online and you're hit with all these things that, that are going on in the world. And on TV, it's just overwhelming sometimes, the economy and the oil slick and just so many serious issues. But don't we need a laugh now and then? Don't we need to have some fun?
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I'm not saying that finding a dead body is fun necessarily, but it, I tried to handle it in a really light way. It's not gory. It's not CSI. It's not a police procedural book. It's just kind of fun. And it's the kind of thing that I think a lot of people have said, I can relate to this. I can relate to my husband and me talking about this. I can relate about because girlfriends are very important in this book, women, supports, friendships. I can relate to an adult child moving home, sort of showing up on the doorstep, which is another issue that we deal with when we reach a certain age. It can certainly happen. And, of course, there are the dogs. I mean, we have dogs that you alluded to the dogs when you introduced me, and we have English Cocker Spaniels, and they are critical to solving the first mystery, and they're even more critical in the second. I can't tell you that part, but I love the dogs. The dogs are a lot of fun.
Now, you alluded earlier to that, that we have so many sources of story ideas, and I would certainly agree that just watching the news, you know, is a pulled from the headlines kind of a thing can probably keep you busy with topics for a long time. But do you have a favorite source for your story ideas?
Well, you know, I do have to confess this. Is this a national call? I mean, I love going out and overhearing other people's conversations. Isn't that terrible? But, you know, you go and stand in the line in the supermarket, and you're waiting to check out your groceries, and people talk about the darndest things, and they, or these people with the Bluetooth or whatever those things are, stick in their ears, and they're talking, they're having a conversation. Does anybody know that you can hear what they're saying? Some of the things that people talk about are just unbelievable in a public place. I don't need to turn on the TV to get inspired. I just need to go out and go to a store and walk around and listen to people's conversations. They're hysterical. They're funnier most of the time than anything I could possibly think of. So my inspiration really comes from real life.
Excellent. All right. Well, then that would mean that conversations that we read, and I thought you did that very well in this book, was the conversations are so realistic. I could just picture them happening, and I think that that's, for me, one of the things that I would find most challenging about writing a book is how do I make the people sound real?
Well, thank you. The lunch that takes place in the very first chapter is based on an incident that actually happened in my life where I was sitting having lunch with three college friends, and they were all talking about retirement. And it was such an interesting conversation that was almost the springboard for the characters, the women friends in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're all exaggerated, certainly, but real life has so many. In fact, you know, you've heard the expression, truth is stranger than fiction. Frequently,
mm-hmm.
It is stranger than fiction. I just to segue for a moment, I just thought of something. When I do book signings, and I do a lot of them for women's clubs and all kinds of places, sometimes women can't wait to run in and tell me stories about what happens when their husband has retired. And one woman said to me, "Oh my God, I couldn't wait to meet you because I want to tell you that when my husband retired, I slept late one morning and I got up and he alphabetized everything in my kitchen." And I thought, "Oh my God." And then another woman said, "Oh, I can top that. I got up and I walked in and he had completely rearranged my purse." Now, come on, Ann. You know,
mm-hmm.
these guys need to get a life. But anyway, some of the stories are hysterical. They're really funny.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can certainly imagine that. Since you're writing a series, I guess you're into the second book, so
mm-hmm.
I can ask you, what do you think is the best part about writing a series?
Oh, because you get to know the characters so much better. The first time, of course, it's, and people have said to me, "You know, do you have an outline?" I don't really have an outline. I knew when I started the first book who the victim was going to be, what the method was going to be,
mm-hmm.
and what the motive was going to be, and I knew who the murderer was going to be. But I didn't really have the plot. I had the beginning and I had the end. And there's that big middle there, Anne. You know, there's that, like, 65,000-word middle that you got to fill in. And of course, I was really making up the characters from my own, you know, my own head, which, of course, everybody does when you're writing fiction. But I would go to sleep at night and I would worry that I'd gotten somebody into a corner and I wasn't going to be able to get them out. And then somehow you get these ideas. And I would get up and I would write them down, and then I would get up in the morning and I would strain to read my writing, and I would get back to the book and I could actually see that it made sense. So
mm-hmm.
now in the second book, I'm really getting to know the characters more, because the characters were superficial, I guess, a little bit in the first book, because they were fun but nothing was really going on. It was terribly, terribly serious, except of course
mm-hmm.
for that pesky dead body. But in the second book, it's a little bit more of a serious vein. It's still hopefully humorous, but I'm really getting to know the characters more. And that may sound odd because, you know, it is coming from my own head after all, but when you're writing in the second book, I would write something and then this voice would come into my head and say, "I would never do that. I would never wear that. I would never do that. Fix that." And I would say, "Okay," and I would go back and fix it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they become so real that you think I should be committed. I mean,
No.
They become so real to me.
All right. And having never written anything fictional, you know, like you, being that I've worked in PR and marketing all my life,
mm-hmm.
I've done tons of writing, but I've never gotten past the part where I think about how I would start a novel in my head. You know, a number of times I've pictured, well, how would a novel start, and who do I know that I could modify things that I've seen or heard that could be expanded upon to make an interesting story. But that's as far as I get is the thinking about it part. And you said that you didn't really work from an outline, so can you share with us what is your method for building the story?
Well, I write as I would like to read the book. I always, I'm always making notes. I have notes all over the house and little notepads and stuff. I have a note pad in the car, in my purse all the time. I'm always coming up with ideas. I've learned from the first book that I cannot rush it, that it will come. If I'm not going to stress about it. If there's a day that it's just not working for me, then I'll just shut off the computer and I'll just take myself out of the house, and I'll just go to some place outside of the house and just kind of walk around for a little while and listen to conversations and stuff. I always have an idea about what's going to happen, and before I shut the computer off, I jot down that idea that sort of gives me a springboard for the next scene. But then before I turn the computer back on again, something else may have occurred to me from a chance remark that I might have heard that will springboard something in my head, and I'll think, well, you know, that could work. That's a little bit different. Let's try that. So I'm now the first novel was 72,000 words. I am now 54,000 words into book two, which is not to say that it's a finished product by any stretch of the imagination, but it's the first draft. And it may change a little bit as we go along, but I'm open to all kinds of possibilities. And I think that's probably one of the things that you have to do when you're writing fiction. You have to be open to changing things because, for instance, the ending to the first book changed when I read it again and I had other readers read it, the ending changed. And where that came from, I have no idea. Somebody else suggested something and then one thing led to another. But I think when you're writing and you're making things up, you have to be open to the wildest possibilities because you never know where it's going to lead you. And it's so much fun. It's just so much fun.
Okay, well, that's fascinating. Now, one of the questions I was going to ask is if you were an advocate of that you have a set time every day that you sit down and write so that it becomes kind of like a job. But it sounds like what you're saying, that if the muse isn't there, you go and look for other things to do. So.
But I do try first thing in the morning to sit down and to do some writing. It may be only 20 minutes. It may be an hour and a half. It may be, but I try to visit the characters. That's the way I sort of, I'm going to see what Jim and Carol are up to today. That's the way I do it. And I try to do that every day. And even if it's only a couple of minutes, and I don't beat myself up if I only spend 15 or 20 minutes there, because I know that I'll get back to it again, you know. So, because to me, I'm the first reader. I'm the one. I really feel like I'm writing this to entertain myself, and if other people like it too, that's a wonderful gift for me.
Right. Excellent. Well, I want to tell our listeners here that I see we're almost to the half hour, and I still have a couple more questions. So if they'll bear with me, I'm going to finish my questions, and then I'll open the call. I promise I will open the call because I do want to get our listeners to have the chance to ask you questions. But let me ask you one. I think that's a really important question for anyone who's contemplating becoming a fiction writer, and that is, can you talk to us a little bit about what part of the writing process have you found the most challenging? And how did you overcome that?
Ooh, I think that you have to be disciplined when you're a writer. I mean, I've talked about the fact that if the muse isn't there, I get up and I leave and I just go out and do something else. But you have to be disciplined and do it frequently. You have to do it. It's really important to do it every day because when you do it every day, even if it's only for a few minutes, you get into, I call it getting into the zone. And the more you do it, it's like anything else. It's like practice. The more you do it, the better you get at it. And everybody has a story. Everybody has a story to tell, whether it's a fictional story or whether it's a memoir or whatever. And whatever you have to say is important. And, you know, just sit down and start to do it.
Now, you talked a little bit about the characters, how they've developed to the point where they speak to you a little bit and say, I would never wear that or I would never say that. But could you talk a little bit about the whole process of character development?
Well, that's interesting because, you know, I think every writer, and, of course, I'd like to talk a little bit about Sisters in Crime because that's a tremendously helpful series. And they have wonderful online courses and that you can take to learn how to do different things like how to write a synopsis and how to write a query letter and all that kind of thing. And one of the things that we talk about a lot is how to develop characters. most people, I think, most writers base characters on people that they actually know in real life. Not to the point where you could sit down and say, well, that's obviously you, Anne. You know, there's no kidding around. That's obviously you. But, you know, we all have people in our lives that we can take, and we all have people that annoy us, for instance, and we can take that person and we can fictionalize that person and make them the villain, for instance, or bump them off or whatever. I think we all, in real life, we all have so many different people who are part of our lives, and I think that was certainly the basis for my characters. I've been blessed with a large group of very wonderful, supportive women friends over the years, some of them whom we've been friends for over 40 years, and I really use that pool of people to draw the characters. One of the characters, Maria, who runs the local restaurant in town, is a retired teacher, and she is really based on a cousin of mine who is a retired teacher who actually began to cook. She never started cooking. She never cooked in her life before, but after she retired, she started to cook. So I took that, and I just it just kept going with it, and I actually gave her a restaurant, and she loved it. She thought that was great, because all of a sudden she was a restaurateur in her retirement years. So I think you just use who you know and just sort of, you know, add to it a little bit, exaggerate it a little bit. That's what I've done anyway.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I will open the call up. And that is, I've noticed that your publisher is Baby Boomer Mysteries Press. And I'd like to know more about that. And I guess a secondary question with that is, how convoluted was your path to publication? Because, you know, that's always the other thing is once you get it written, how do you find a publisher?
Well, that's an interesting question. I went through the process of the first thing you do is you target, you know, agents who have who like what is called a cozy mystery, which is what this is. And then you send out what's called a query letter, which is basically a pitch letter, a sell. You know, you must look at this book because it's really going to be great. And through Sisters in Crime, I had leads on agents that were interested in this kind of book. The first agent I queried was the agent who sold The Nanny Diaries, which was a big sale, obviously, huge deal. And she liked it. So she asked me for a synopsis, which is the entire book boiled down to 500 words. If you can imagine taking 72,000 words and boiling them down to 500 words.
Wow.
And telling the entire story, including who the murderer is, what the motive is, and all that. And she asked for the first chapter. She loved it. She asked for the first three chapters. She loved it. Then she asked for what's called a full. Now, this is a big deal when a major agent asks for a full. Well, you know, Anne, she loved it, but she wasn't sure there was an audience for this book. And I'm saying, hello, 78 million boomers? Are you kidding me? But, you know, a lot of the people today that are in the publishing business are in their 30s. They may not quite get this market, I don't think.
Right.
So that did not work out. Then I had another agent, went through the same process, absolutely loved it. And to get to the point where they asked for a full is a big deal. And she had the same problem. She wasn't sure if she could sell it to – she wasn't sure there was an audience for it. And I found this astonishing because there were so many boomers out there. And then another agent, the third agent, loved it. But she wanted it completely rewritten with more bodies, more blood, more gore. You know, vampires are in these days, CSI, all that bloody stuff. And that's not the kind of book that I like to read, and it's certainly not the kind of book that I wanted to write. So that's when my husband, whom I call my beloved, my personal beloved, and I decided to start Baby Boomer Mysteries. And so he writes for a magazine on Cape Cod, and we use their designers, their printers, all of their publicity people, and we put together this package called Baby Boomer Mysteries. And so that's how the whole thing came to be born, I guess one would say. So that's how we did it.
Would you advocate that as a way for other people to publish, or would you consider taking on other authors into your...
Well, we have been queried by other authors. At this point, we are not soliciting any manuscripts right now. I'm not saying we wouldn't do that, but right now we're not in that mode. I think that for the publishing business today, unfortunately, is not the way it used to be. a lot of publishing houses are folding. They're very hesitant to take on a writer who does not have a national name, which I did not have. And so it's very hard at this stage to break into the publishing field. So I think a lot of people are using some of these self-publishing venues like iUniverse or Author House and stuff, where you're given a package of things to choose from. We chose not to do that. We wanted to control everything ourselves, and I'm very pleased with the way that it came out.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly a beautiful book. I mean, it's you know, from the point of view of what you hold in your hand.
Thank you.
They did a nice job with that.
Can I just ask, is one thing about the cover? Because the cover is two rocking chairs on a porch here on Cape Cod. And we took the – it was actually a photograph that we took on a friend's porch on the 1st of January in 2009 after a snowstorm. And the book takes place in the summer. So before we took the picture, we had to shovel the porch off and make it look like summer.
Right.
And then we put these two rockers out, and we put a pitcher of lemonade and a few other little things. And the original idea was that one of the dogs was supposed to sit in the rocking chair. But this is Lucy. But she kept running around the yard, so we forgot that part. That didn't happen. But people who have seen the cover have said that it's such a wonderful metaphor for marriage, because there are two high-backed white rockers, but they're not identical, but they go together. And they said, what a wonderful metaphor for marriage that is. And my answer is, well, no, those are the rockers that my friend Joyce had in her attic, and that's what we used. So that's the story of the cover.
And then which dog is that on the back?
That's Lucy, who is actually lying here at my feet adoringly right now. That's Lucy.
Well, okay, wonderful. Excellent. Now, another thing... You talked about the breaking into publishing and not having a name. Another thing that I think people need to be aware of, and perhaps you could talk to us a little bit about, is the how much an author actually has to take charge of marketing the book once you put it out there.
Well, I'm told that, you know, through Sisters in Crime, because there are a lot of, you know, really well-known authors who are on this, who are members of Sisters in Crime, and they share a lot of their experiences. And in today's publishing market, authors, even well-known authors, have to do a lot of their own marketing themselves. And, of course, I'm doing all of my own marketing, really, although we did hire a publicity agent for the first couple of months to kind of get us into the national reviews, which really worked out really well. But you have to really do a lot of it yourself. And if you don't, a lot of it's done on the web, of course. But I happen to like going out and talking to people. I love talking to other women. I love talking to wives. I love sharing the stories. It's been a lot of fun. And I'm doing a lot. Like tomorrow I'm doing here in the Cape, I'm doing a retirement tea with a long-term care planning specialist and a financial person who specializes in retirement for women. And we do a series of teas where I talk about the book and then they talk about their issues. And we have this beautiful high tea that we serve, and it's a lot of fun. And women come from all over the Cape, and they buy the book.
Excellent. Well, I guess I should give you one other thing to talk about before we open it up, and that is, how can someone buy your book, and how do you go about figuring out what price to charge?
Well, I went to, you know, the local bookstores and just looked at the size of the book and the number of pages, and that's where we came up with the price of $14.95. The book is, well, it's obviously available in a lot of local bookstores in New England, but it's available on Amazon.com, and our website is babyboomermysteries.com, and if you go on that website, that will lead you to my email address, and I would be happy to send you out a book and you know, certainly to personalize it and all that, so... and people, a lot of people are buying it just to give as gifts for people who are retiring. And we've also had young women who have given it to, you know, to their mothers and you know, daddy's going to retire. I think mom needs to read this book. So.
Okay. Well, I have unmuted the call. So
okay.
any of our, listeners here would like to, speak up and ask, Susan a question. We'd love to hear from you. Don't be shy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, then I
I'm going to jump in.
Good, good.
My name is Jane Rosenthal. I'm calling you all from a ranch in the Sierra Mountains of California. This has been a great half hour.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you for doing this. And I'd just like to say that my experience is very similar to yours about the agents and so forth and loving the book, but there's no market. So I wondered what you thought of e-publishing.
Well, I haven't really gotten into that. There are many sites today for e-publishing, but I haven't really investigated that. I'm an old-fashioned kind of a person. I like to hold a book in my hand and turn the pages. But I'm interested, Jane. What kind of a book have you written?
Well, I've written mysteries. And,
oh, good for you.
And they're set in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that. You know, it was the same thing, you know, query, yes, the first chapter, yes, more
mm-hmm.
chapters, yes,
mm-hmm.
and but that my book just didn't reach a large enough audience.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so basically we retired to Horse Ranch, and I went to work doing all of that, and then I just pulled these books out and thought, you know, these are really good. Maybe I shouldn't drop this, and I should just take matters into my own hands. And I was thinking of you know, just going the iUniverse route,
yeah,
just because
yeah.
so many people had asked to see the book. But then my mother-in-law, who is 98, and my father, who's 96, are getting iPads.
No kidding.
So they can read. And my
wow.
dad just read, you know, the Stieg Larsson mysteries
yes.
on the
wow.
iPad. So I started to think maybe we will, you know, for certain kinds of books and for traveling, for instance, which a lot of retirees do.
That's true.
You know, you want to download a number of things that you can read. So anyway, that was
well, that's
what
interesting.
I started thinking.
I need to add that to my to-do list. I really do. And may I ask, Annie, you a member of Sisters in Crime? Have you joined that organization?
You know, I lived in the Bay Area. I lived in Berkeley, and I knew a lot of people, who, and I have gone to meetings, and I've taken a lot of workshops, one with Elizabeth George
mm-hmm. oh,
at
yes.
Books Passage that was really wonderful. And
mm-hmm.
actually, that's how I got my first agent through that whole process. So I was all very excited then, and just I thought this is it, because Elizabeth George thinks this is great, you know, and whatever. Mm-hmm. And boom, you know, same experience as you had. So but I was really interested, and I can't wait to read your book.
Well, I would suggest that you join. It's only $45 a year, I believe, and you know
uh-huh.
what you get online. The access that you get online is just extraordinary for that little amount of money. You don't have to even
oh, yeah.
go to any meetings. So, you know, you might want to think about that.
Okay, I will. And I want to say I really love this site, and now the work that you're doing on it. I just really appreciate
it. Oh, thank
it.
You.
It's, I live on 50 acres with horses and cattle and so
wow.
forth, and it's been a long-term dream. But it's also it's great to be able to sit down in front of the computer and feel like I'm connecting with other women who are at this stage of in their lives. So anyway,
well, I'm so glad to hear that.
Anybody else? Is anybody else out there?
I heard a lot of beeps at one point.
We have other people on the call, so speak up.
Okay.
We're happy
speak
to hear
up.
From you.
I would like to hear from you.
So would I. I can hear them breathing.
They're shy.
Well, I thought that was interesting what you just said about the iPad, because I was talking to my 80-year-old mother last
uh-huh.
night, and she was telling me about the importance of her Kindle, that she was saying that
yeah.
that with her arthritis, and she loves to read, but she was saying that the Kindle makes it so much easier for her to hold and turn the pages and everything. So I do think that, well, I don't have one yet, that I'm mm-hmm. I'm going to have to get myself an iPad. And,
yeah, and mine needs to be on Kindle as well. I mean, that's
yeah.
definitely, you know, these are all things that you need to do yourself.
Yeah.
And it's quite as simple as it seems.
I know.
A lot of the technology stuff is not quite as simple. I suppose my grandson could probably figure it out. You know, he's 10.
And there are people who can format it for free. There's something called eBooks Architects in
right.
Texas and stuff.
Right.
They can do things like that. I mean, for those of us who aren't willing to form our own publishing house, which I think is a great idea, and I know someone in Santa Fe who's done that, Martha Egan. Do you, you know, are you, how do you how does one feel about iUniverse, for example?
Well, there's a tremendous writers community here in Cape Cod,
uh-huh.
which is where I spend, I would say, maybe 60% of my time.
Yeah.
And several of the authors that I have met here have used iUniverse and have been very pleased with the quality of their work. My problem with iUniverse is that I guess I'm a control freak in some ways. I like to I don't like to buy a package.
Yeah. Okay.
I like to know that I'm going to have X amount of books for the first printing, and that you know I'm going to get to choose the color. I mean, I can't tell you what we went through to choose the colors for the cover of the book, for instance,
mm-hmm.
or the typeface for the book.
Yeah.
It was a tremendous long process to figure out the size of the typeface, for instance, because we did not want to do a large print book. But we wanted to make it easy for you know a little bit older eyes to read, and you don't get that kind of choice when you use something like iUniverse or AuthorHouse. But you know there are several writers that I know who have used them and have been very happy with the product that they've gotten. So you know it's all in what you want. I think also a lot of people. I think the term self-publishing is one term that a lot of people look down on, a lot of people in the writing community. I don't think of what we have done as self-publishing as much as I think of it as independent publishing. And because we really have done our own, we have our own group of people who have put together this product and will continue to put together this product. And honestly, I do have an agent who is interested in book two. In fact, one of the agents who passed on book one, but really wanted
right,
to
right,
book
right.
two. And I mean, I'm not saying that if somebody gave me $1 million and a movie contract, I wouldn't say, oh, here, take it. But I like the way that we have put it together and the fact that it's a product that we have designed and we have put a lot of time and effort into, and it's ours. And I don't know whether I would want to, you know, give that up. I already have somebody who's designing the cover for the second book, and when you get into publishing in a mainstream house, it's going to be a year at least before something comes out. I mean, this is not a quick process, and I'm hoping to have something out on the market by Christmas, because
right.
I have people who've said, you know, what's going on? We want the second book, and it's not like, you know, you sit down and in 24 hours you have another novel, but I really like that sense of control, so...
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. And I think once you've gone through a process where a number of people have read it, including editors, including agents, and have said good things about it or guided
mm-hmm.
you in some way, and you've taken that advice, I think at some point you can feel fairly confident that,
yeah,
you know, with your own effort and PR and so forth, you might be able to market this book.
Well, I mean, I'm doing things now and meeting people that I never in my wildest dreams would have imagined. One of the things that I'm doing is you have to think out of the box these days. And I did a mystery panel at a Borders Books in Connecticut, because the book
uh-huh.
takes place in Fairfield County, Connecticut. I did a mystery panel with three, quote, legitimate mystery writers and me.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, this is going to be stressful. I'm going to have a migraine because, you know, who am I? But one of the questions that came from the audience was about marketing the book. And so I sort of raised my hand and I talked about the fact that one of the ways I'm doing a lot of cross-marketing, and people looked at me like, well, what does that mean? And I talked about these retirement teas that I just mentioned, that we do these with other people who are in the retirement genre, the long-term care, the estate planning, all that kind of thing. But I also do dog shows. There are dogs. There are two dogs in the book. Their names are Lucy and Ethel, and I'm sure that we can all figure out why they're named Lucy and Ethel. And one of our dogs is named Lucy, and so for Christmas, just for ha-has, I sent the breeder of our Lucy, whom we had not spoken to in 8 years since we bought the dog, a bookmark which has Lucy's picture on it, because Lucy's on the, as Anne knows, Lucy's on the back
yeah.
of the book. And she got hysterical about this. She thought this was the greatest thing, so she invited me to come to the American Spaniel Club's National Winter Dog Show in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania
uh-huh.
in January. And I was there as like this guest, this celebrity guest, sold tons of books. They made announcements over the PA system. I gave out loads of autographs, had my picture taken. It was hysterical. And then the books went out to the English Cocker Club show in Wisconsin. They've made the dog show circuit. I just did the Greenwich Kennel Club in Connecticut. I'm doing another dog show here in the Cape. And people come and buy the books because there are dogs in it. So who knew? So you got to be creative.
Hello?
Selling your books.
Great advice. Thank you so much for this. And it's just been really inspiring listening to all of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
I'm good. Bye-bye.
Bye. Anyone else? Well, Susan, you talked about this marketing through the kennels would you say that there's any other successful marketing and promotion ideas that you've given thought to or that you'd like to share?
Well, you know, there are so many when you look at a book, there are not it's not just a library or a bookstore that may be interested in a book. My book is in libraries in Connecticut and in Massachusetts, but and it's also being sold in a lot of bookstores. However, it's also being sold in gift shops, consignment shops. One of the things is that part of the proceeds of the book goes to support the Breast Cancer Survival Center, which you mentioned, Anne, in your introduction. And when I sell the book, if I'm doing a book signing, I put the pink ribbon on the book, the pink breast cancer ribbon, so people will know that part of the money goes to support breast cancer as well. And we're going to be doing some things with the local hospital here. There are, when you sell a book through a bookstore, I don't know whether people know this or not, but if you sell a book, and I'm saying this as an independent author, the bookstore takes 40% normally of the sticker price of the book, and the author gets 60%, which is pretty standard. So that means that if you were to sell your book, if I were to sell my book, rather, in any store or for any organization or whatever, if you devise a 60-40 split, that's standard. So because I could do this, I can make these decisions on my own, I can do this with any kind of an organization. I can approach a women's club and say, do you want to do a fundraiser to make some money for scholarship, let's say.
Right.
If you let me come and do a book talk and sell books, I will give you 40% of everything that's sold. And so, you know, for that reason, I've become quite popular on the women's club circuit because it can be used as a benefit.
Program, right. The women clubs are, or all kinds of clubs, are always needing programs. So
that's right.
So this is a good concept. And you're reminding me of a friend of mine who, her book is an outlet. We've been helping her build her website, which is, her book is about thrifting, the concept of how you can decorate your house with things that you buy at thrift and consignment.
Oh, I love that. Oh.
And so she was telling me she calls herself the Thrift Talk Diva, actually that's her domain name is Thrift Talk Diva. But she was telling me that she's been making arrangements with a lot of the Goodwill stores and you know other thrift type stores to sell her books there. Which in the case that her book isn't so much a fiction, it's how to you know, have a beautiful life that you know a beautiful home, you know, do it on a thrift budget. So that ties in very well for her. So I think what we're hearing here is the concept of that we need to use a lot of creativity when we think about how we can market our books.
Well, I have to tell you that there is a thrift shop in the second book in the series.
Okay.
And one of the things that is important to me here on Cape Cod is the Cape Cod Hospital, and they have a wonderful thrift shop, and I volunteer there a couple of days a week when I'm here. A lot of the volunteers who are there are in their 80s. Mm-hmm. And I hear the most wonderful stories from them. And it really gives me hope to, you know, keep on trucking every day. But, of course, you know, we don't even have to talk about the shopping opportunities, which are just absolutely fantastic. But thrift shops today are really the place to get the bargains. And everybody knows that I'm a thrift shop person, and they will look at me and they will say, well, you know, where'd you get that? And I'll say, well, you know, my little boutique. and my chic little boutique on Cape Cod. And I have met the most incredible people at the hospital thrift shop, including, you know, local reporters who did a big cover story about me in one of the big newspapers here last year about the book, just because I happened to be talking to somebody about this book, about writing the book last year, and she overheard the conversation, and the next thing I knew, I was interviewed by a reporter, and I was on the front cover of this magazine that's published by our daily paper called Prime Time, and so I finally became a cover girl. At the age of and I was in every supermarket on Cape Cod for a month, and people gave me really funny looks. But, you know, when you go to thrift shops, you never know what you're going to meet, who you're going to meet.
Well, that's what she says. I have to say that where I live, I'm not aware of too many thrift shops. So
really?
You have to move.
I mean, there's no doubt. You have to move.
I'll have to think. Maybe it's just that I haven't found them. Maybe they're, you know, I do know of a couple, so I shouldn't say there are none, but I live in a very small community, so I might have to expand my shopping out of this marketplace. But you talked about the responses from people in the stores or from seeing that you were on the cover of that magazine.
Mm-hmm.
But would you, as we close here, let me ask you: have you received any really memorable responses from readers from the book?
Well, you know, several people have stopped me and said, "Thank you for talking about life as it really is." It makes me feel good to know they've said, you know, you really have hit the nail on the head with what life is really like. And that's a good thing. It's nice to see that people of our age are being portrayed by having a real life and having a good time and enjoying themselves. But that's been very gratifying. But yet, younger people who've said that when they've read the book, it really showed them what relationships can be like as you get older. And it made them, I think, in some ways, understand their parents a little bit more, too. The one negative comment that I had was I did a book club last year here, and in the book I referred to the husband as my beloved. And this young woman who was in the book club looked at me. Her arms were folded, and obviously the body language was, she was not a happy camper. And she looked at me and she said, "Well, I love the book, but this, do you call your husband my beloved?" That really bugged me. And I looked her right in the eye and I said, "No, I call him my personal beloved." And that, she just started to laugh. So he's my PB, my personal beloved.
Excellent. Well, is there anything else that I've neglected to ask that you'd like to say?
Well, I just think that the organization that you run is just a fantastic thing, and I'm so pleased that you've taken over from Dotsy. And oh, by the way, Dotsy was, and I'm sure, I hope everybody knows who I'm talking about, Dotsy Briegel, was one of the first people to comment on the book. So that we're in our third printing, but a quote from her was on the back of the very first printing of the book, in which she, of course, said good things about it. Thank God, but.
Right.
We're sort of involved with Baby Boomer Women. We've been from the very beginning, and we're just so happy to be involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're a huge group of people. You know, we can't be ignored.
No, absolutely. That's right.
Well, Susan, I don't hear anybody else that's being brave that wants to speak up, and since we are kind of at the top of our hour here, I'm going to close the call and tell you that it's been really wonderful talking to you. I want to thank you for being my guest.
Oh, thank you, Anne, very much. It's been a lot of fun.
And thanks to everyone else who's on the call, would speak with us or not. And I will say, wonderful. I look forward to your next book, Susan, and I hope it will be. I'm glad to hear it's going to be before Christmas.
No, I hope so. I'm working on it. I'm trying.
Okay.
I'll keep you posted.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to say goodbye for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.